Last fall, my wife and I went to the Holt Center to watch Les Mis. How many of you guys were able to do that? Some behind, right? Yeah. I had always wanted to go see it. I was really familiar with the story. I'd seen a couple of the movie adaptations. Never read the book because it's 1,200 pages, and there's just, I don't want to know that much about the Paris sewer system, you know, but... going to see the play was one of the most powerful artistic experiences I have ever had. It blew me away. For those who aren't familiar, there's a scene in there right at the beginning. It's the story of a man named Jean Valjean, who was in prison doing hard labor in France for 19 years for the crime of stealing a loaf of bread. And at the very beginning of the play, he's been given a parole pass. And so now he's free, but he's destitute, you know. He's utterly broken. He's angry. He tries to find lodging as he's traveling the countryside, and he's getting thrown out, you know. And he wants food, but people won't feed him, and they're scared, and they see that parole pass. And finally, someone says, go knock on that door. And so he goes and knocks on the door of the bishop. And when he does, the bishop doesn't just open up his door and give him food. He invites him in. And they share a meal together. And he hears his story. And the bishop treats him with dignity. Even to the point of saying, here, stay in my house. Here's a bed for you. Here's clean sheets. Something he hadn't experienced in 19 years. Well, Jean Valjean, of course, wakes up in the middle of the night and decides that the best way forward is for him to get up and to grab that silver, the basket of silver that he saw, that he kept thinking about, and to grab that and to sneak away and to run away and to have something to begin his life with. The bishop wakes up the next morning. This is where I've gone to the book to fill in a little more. He wakes up the next morning and his servant realizes what's happened, and she's so upset, and he's not. In fact, he says, look, I probably should have, you know, given that to the poor anyway. And, well, was that man not poor? It's okay. And she's livid, and she's talking about, what are we going to eat on? He's like, well, we have these plates. Well, those smell. And what about those? You know, like, he's got all of these other options, and she's just so upset. And finally, while they're having this conversation, three policemen walk into the home with Jean Valjean. They've captured him. And here is what takes place. The bishop sees Jean Valjean. He says, ah, there you are. I'm glad to see you. But I gave you the candlesticks also, which are also silver like the rest, and would bring you 200 francs. Why did you not take them with the plates? The guards are totally confounded. Jean Valjean is stunned. He sends the policeman away. And here's how it reads. The bishop approached him and said in a low voice, forget not, never forget that you have promised to use this silver to become an honest man. Jean Valjean, who had no recollection of this promise, stood confounded. The bishop had laid much stress upon these words as he uttered them. He continued solemnly, Jean Valjean, my brother, you belong no longer to evil, but to good. It is your soul that I am buying for you. I withdraw it from dark thoughts and from the spirit of perdition, and I give it to God. That's the very beginning of the play and of the book. It's a powerful story. Now, that's a famous scene, not only for the theological depth, because it's touching on atonement, it's an incredible story, right? But it's powerful because of the effect it has on this character all the way through. Because he does indeed take those candlesticks and the thing the bishop now has given him that he tried to steal, but now he can't steal because the bishop gave them to him. And he does indeed start a new life, and he becomes a new man, an honest man. He becomes actually a wealthy man and a benevolent man, and he lays down his life for the rest of the story for different individuals, even at great, great cost to himself, he keeps on giving. It is a powerful testimony. And the reason I love this so much is it makes me think of what Paul said about the kindness of God. It is the kindness of God that leads us to repentance. We are talking, of course, about the fruit of the Spirit in this series. If the Spirit is present in our lives, we should expect certain things to be happening. Like love should be growing, joy, peace, patience, all of these things which we've been talking about in the last several weeks. And then we get to kindness. And kindness is interesting. Kindness, I think we could agree on the others that this is should be normal, but it's funny how when it comes to kindness, I keep seeing people lately, this seems like a recent development, but I keep seeing people sort of imply that kindness is optional for a Christian. Like, or worse, that kindness and compassion can be seen as almost an affront to truth. Now, generally, I think people, when they're saying these things, they're concerned that being kind means never confronting a person about anything. And I think that's the concern. But I think what they're doing is actually confusing kindness with niceness. Okay? Now, this week, I did something that I thought was kind of fun. I asked people on Facebook, and some of you guys responded, how do you see the difference between kindness and niceness? And I got some really insightful responses. It was a really fun thread. You should take a look at it later again. But people talked about niceness being about politeness. That was interesting. It was mostly about being polite. It's not always authentic. It doesn't actually cost a person everything. Niceness is really closely aligned with our individual cultural context. So when we're being nice, in other words, we are meeting basic cultural expectations of pleasantness, okay? It's what you would expect. Now, that changes sort of where you are, but it's more like, you know, we're talking about being civil. Now, you guys, I am from the South, so I know all about this. Because in the South, everyone expects you to be pleasant, church people especially. Like there's something, it just needs to be like sort of wrapped. Whatever you're talking about, there's like this sort of, this veneer of civility that everything has to be wrapped in and pleasantness. Now, I want to say that's not necessarily a bad thing before we hammer too much on it. It's not necessarily a bad thing. Like, if we're talking about civility, this is sort of like the lowest bar of human interaction. And it, really, we should be able to clear that bar most of the, you know what I'm saying? Like, to be nice to a person is, you know, it's not such a bad thing, and it has different ways that it looks. I kind of enjoy going back to visiting Texas, sometimes visiting the South. You know, when the guy who's bagging my groceries asks me how my day has been and tells me how his day has been and takes a long time, but it's really just, you know, I kind of enjoy that. I kind of like it when the waitress comes and calls me sweetie, I'll be honest, you know? It's kind of, yeah, you know, it kind of makes me feel at home, you know. But the fact is, the veneer of niceness can also be a great hiding place for things like passive aggression and contempt. For example, if you're in the South and someone says, bless your heart, this does not mean bless his heart. It probably means something akin to, what an idiot, if only he knew. Not all the time, but that is the thing, right? So it can hide things. Similarly, you know, I lived in Minnesota for a few years where my wife is from, and they have something akin to Southern hospitality, but they call it Minnesota Nice. That's what they call it. And in Minnesota Nice is all about pleasantness. Like a good Minnesota is, a Minnesotan is friendly and quiet. Never disturbs, never turns over the apple cart, you know, it's just sort of like, never makes waves. Now, as a result, a lot of things can be swept up under the rug and never addressed. That's the downside of niceness. Niceness can hide things. Now, kindness, though, is a totally different thing. Kindness might begin or it might appear to look like niceness, but there is something so, oh man, it's more solid, it's more weighty. So a Bible scholar named Donald Campbell from the Bible Knowledge Commentary defined kindness in the New Testament this way. Kindness is benevolent action, such as God demonstrates toward men. It's action. So it's not a mood, you know? Niceness is like a mood. Kindness is benevolent action. Romans 2, verses 3 through 5 displays this. This is pretty much plain as day. But do you suppose, O man, When you pass judgment on those who practice such things, talking about practicing wickedness, that you will escape the judgment of God? Or do you think lightly of the riches of his kindness and tolerance and patience, not knowing that the kindness of God leads you to repentance? The benevolent action, it's the kindness of God that draws us in. It's not harshness. It's his benevolence that draws us in, that turns our hearts. And you can see at once why this has to be something bigger than niceness. You know, niceness doesn't change anyone's heart. When you do the bare minimum of what's expected in your cultural context, that doesn't change anybody, does it? But man, radical kindness is transformative. The kind of kindness the bishop showed Jean Valjean, the kind of kindness that Christ showed us on the cross. Kindness is something that we as Christians must display because God has displayed it to us. Look at the words of Christ, Luke 6, 35 and 36. This is Jesus. He says, love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. He is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. You ever think about because you, doesn't it, does that, does anyone of you not like that phrase very much? Like, does it do something, and you're like, but they're ungrateful. Being kind to the wicked is almost not even as bad as being kind to the ungrateful, you know? You're like, they do not deserve this. And he's like, exactly. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. In other words, God is kind. God is kind even to those who hate him. We, therefore, are called to be kind in that same way. Now, so what does that actually look like? Well, on that Facebook thread that I was talking about, I have an author friend from my old publisher. I don't know him well. We've only met a couple times. We worked with the same editor, but he jumped in on that thread, and then he sent me a private message saying, hey, so I wrote this book last year, and I wrote a whole chapter on kindness, and I totally nerded out. Do you want to see it? And then he sent it to me. And I read it, and I was so impressed. I said, hey, do you mind if I quote you in my sermon? He said, yeah, go for it. So his name is Matt Michalatos, and he wrote a book with Kathy Kang, and the book is called Loving Disagreement, published by the good folks over at NAV Press. And here is the snippet he had from his chapter that I want to show you. In English, the word kindness goes back to the old English word kindness, with a Y, which meant roughly nation. But the idea of it came from one's family or one's kin and relations. Kindness was about your nation, your people, and the feelings you had about them. It's a word about the fierce loyalty some of us have for our own families and the generosity and care we give to them as a result. Think of it like this. In a healthy family, you're going to try to help your kin if they have a need, right? If I'm driving to work and I see a stranger whose car is broken down on the side of the road, I might not stop. But if it's my sister or my cousin or my kid, I'll stop for sure, even if I'm going to be late for work. When I stop to help a stranger in need, I'm treating them like my kin. Isn't that interesting? I'm showing them kindness. Kindness is seeing the need and doing active good for other people just like you would for your own family. That's what we're talking about. Isn't that good? It's actively seeking to meet the needs of others, treating them as if they are valuable to us. Unkindness, then, is treating others as if they're not valuable. It's dismissal and callousness and cruelty. It often looks like mockery and condescension. This is the opposite of how Jesus treated people. And we, as Jesus followers, are forbidden to treat people that way. We are forbidden. In fact, we are commanded to be kind. We're commanded to treat others like kin. Does that mean we never confront? No, of course not. We sometimes need to confront in a way that's not just like bare minimum social expectation. Sometimes we need to confront. Niceness is not the priority, in other words. But kindness must be a priority in those situations especially. especially when it comes to times when we have to speak the truth. Guys, Paul is so clear on this matter in 1 Corinthians 13. I don't know how people try to wiggle out of it. I really don't understand it. He's so clear. He says, you can have all knowledge and understand all mysteries. In other words, you can have a really, really good handle on truth. Good for you. If you don't have love, that's worthless. Yeah. It's worthless. In fact, if you try to confront a person without love and kindness, you become a clanging cymbal. You become claws on a chalkboard. Oh, but I just got to speak that. No, if you can't speak it in love, you're going to make things worse. That's what he's telling us. And like, it should give us pause, because sometimes we just think, I gotta say this thing. But guys, let me say it this way. If you can't do it in kindness, best to let someone else do the truth speaking there. Now, I'm not saying this in any kind of corrective. I'm not saying this because Tim and Margene have just been down there just spouting off all kinds of evil nonsense and accusing people of things. That's not what I'm doing. But I am, as we've been talking about, alerting us to the fact that it's an election season. And that means, as it happens every 4 years, everyone's about to lose their minds. We do not have to, friends. There's all kinds of pundits and voices and smart voices and awesome voices that can own the other side. Ha ha, did you see what they did? And then we start thinking, that's more important than acting like Jesus. And we can get sucked into it. And I just want to tell you, we don't have to be. We don't have to be. We can lead with kindness, even with those with whom we vehemently disagree. Isn't that a good word? Vehemently. Sometimes I can't say that right, but I just nailed it. We have the glorious opportunity, friends, to be different during this season. Amen. We have the glorious opportunity to remember the rabbi we actually follow, whose way we walk in. So I want to encourage you, if there are voices that arise that are saying, follow me, and they do not look like Christ or sound like Christ, and there's no kindness in them, this person is not your rabbi. Now, they might be able to teach you some things, but be careful about following the way, especially if they claim Christ. Please be careful if they do not demonstrate the fruit of kindness in their lives. That doesn't mean they don't belong to Christ. It just means there might not be a good person to follow. Are you with me? Can you receive that? And I'm not like, was it vague booking or whatever? Like, I'm not being like, I don't have any person in mind. I'm just saying this happens all of this time. And I want us to be prepared to see that and say, what they said might have been right, but what the way they said it was horrible and it tore that person down. And I'm not going to do that. And I'm not going to share that post. Are you with me? All right. Now, this has been a fun thing to bring up people who exemplify these things very well. And when we thought about the fruit of kindness to interview somebody, Brian Riggs came to mind. Brian Riggs, come on up here. Brian and Amber joined us about 3 years ago now. Is that right? 3 years, something like that?
Yeah, around 3 years.
Around 3 years. And it's been so great getting to know them. And Brian and Amber have become dear friends of mine. And I appreciate this about you, that you sort of seem to just wear this thing, this kindness. Like, you're just very good to people. And as we've asked others about this fruit, is this something that you've just sort of always had?
Yeah, the base root of, I've always had it, I think. Always had a nature of caring for people, seeing people's pain.
Right.
But often not, I might not be able to share it in the spaces that I need to share it.
He's a huge Boston Red Sox fan, and we've sort of traded teams, so I'm also trying to become a Boston Red Sox fan. I just don't watch baseball very often, so
I'll get there.
He became a Mavericks fan for me. It was very kind.
Yeah.
See, kind. He became a Boston Red Sox fan because it was the 1986 World Series when the Red Sox, you know, they had this like long curse, they called it, couldn't win a World Series. They finally make it to the World Series against his team that he was cheering for, the Mets. And then what happened is, it was one of the most famous plays ever, the most humiliating play. This guy, Bill Buckner. Bill, was it Bill?
Bill Buckner, right?
Yeah, Bill Buckner. Legs, yeah. The ball goes under his legs and the Red Sox lose the World Series, and Brian sees the pain on Bill Buckner's face and decides he's going to be a Red Sox fan.
That was it.
He sees the pain of their fan base and is like, I want to share in their pain. This is Brian Riggs.
Yeah.
You see why I love this guy? He's great.
They're playing today. They're playing the Yankees today. Trying to be kind to the Yankees is really hard.
You know, there's limits to all of this, right? I kid. Brian, you were talking about, one of the things you do is you are an instructor with Taekwondo, and you've done that for years now. Mm-hmm. And you talk about kindness growing in us, like that grows in the kids. Tell me about that.
Right. So when you start with Taekwondo or anything, even if it's computer programming or whatever, you're a white belt, right?
Yeah.
You don't know where your feet go. You don't know where to hold your hands. You don't know how to turn your hips. So you learn those things. They're learned responses. And I think kindness is kind of like that, where you're, every act of kindness helps you grow to where you're also kind, where you can do that again and again, and you can get that feedback of kindness.
It's like building a muscle. It's like building skill and becoming more.
Right. And as you learn, as an instructor, my job is to be kind to them, where I praise them, I correct them, and then I give them another praise.
Yeah.
Because I want to build up on that.
Yeah.
If I just come up to say, no, you did that wrong. You need to squash the bug. You need to raise your... If I did that as a teaching mechanism, it would not work very well. It would not lead people to their next belt where they need to be.
Right. So both in teaching someone and in receiving and learning, it's a thing you grow in, and then it becomes easier over time. Okay, so you had a circumstance when you were coming out of a movie theater one time, and tell me about that.
Yeah, so I went with a couple friends downtown Eugene, so it was one of those small downtown Eugene movie theaters. We were watching Fred Rogers' movie.
Oh, that was a good movie.
It was a good movie of kindness. And we came out, and I heard this voice saying, can I have a dollar? And I'm like, I am not the type of person who gives people money.
In that setting.
Yeah. Right. Because I can be nervous, I'm not in that comfortable in that situation, but I'm at the time I was a black belt candidate, and I was like, you know what, I can take care of myself. I can handle this. And so but right when I thought that, the Lord said, you have $1. I also don't carry cash. You have $1. So something in me, all of a sudden I didn't know it, and I turned around, I'm like, I have a dollar. And there's a part of me, you know, the movie Inside Out, where you have all these voices in your head. There's a voice in my head going, what are you doing?
Right.
Do not do this. But there was a bigger voice saying, you know, you have a dollar and you can talk to this person. So I turned around and then I walked up to him and I said, I have a dollar. And then I can't believe I said the next words, but I need to pray for you. And I could just see the whole countenance of his face change.
Yeah.
He went from this kind of this rough hoodlum kind of kid to just this open, very open. And his name was Jacob. And so I put my hand on him and I prayed for him.
Yeah.
And at that moment it became something that was like, oh, wow.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's one of those pivotal moments I believe in my life where I earned my next belt.
Right.
Oh, you
see what he did there?
So yeah.
That was well done. You didn't do that when we were talking about this earlier.
I didn't.
I like it.
It just poof,
improvised.
Came right into my little noggin and I just said it.
That usually doesn't
work out that well.
There was another story. We actually had you share this a couple of years ago, but I thought about it. I'm like, you got to tell this story again about Scott. You were a moderator on a group that was like politically minded, but like had a real diversity of political viewpoint. And so you were a moderator for this group that had thousands of people. And there was this man, Scott, who was not, he was making a mess of things because he's being really obnoxious. Tell me about that.
He was so obnoxious. This Scott guy, he was kind of a polar opposite to what I am, religiously, spiritually, lifestyle wise.
Yeah.
And I kept on having problems with him in the group, and I'm like, oh, he's saying this. And so we had a little moderator group where all the moderators would get together and we'd talk. And we'd like, can we get rid of Scott? I can push a button. I can send him out of this private group of 15,000 people. And we don't have to worry about him anymore. And to their credit, they're like, you know, no, we're trying to bring people together.
let's bring people together. I'm like, and so I asked again. And then I asked again, and I asked a couple times. And then something is like, you know what? They're right. I need to reach out to him. And so I sent him a private message. I'm like, hey, Scott, Brian here. I know we've kind of bumped heads a little bit in the group, and I just want to get to know you because I think there's a different way to go about this. Yeah. And so through that, we discovered we both like Great Britain. And so it's one of those things that we kind of, and then I'm like, yeah, I have four girls. I do Taekwondo. I really care about people. And maybe that was a revelation to him because in the group, I wasn't very caring. I wasn't very kind.
Interesting.
And our relationship grew from that to the point of I even had a Zoom meeting with him, a live video, and I put I took a picture of Buckingham Palace and I put it in the background. It was really funny. And he got to the point where he's like, you know, I'm thinking about you. I'm sending happiness, happy thoughts to your children, and you're a great father, and you do this and that. And we became friends on Facebook, even after he left our group.
Yeah.
And it became something that was very special. And he developed pancreatic cancer. Yeah. So as he was progressing through that experience, he sent me a two pictures of him in London. Hmm. And when I got it, I knew what it was.
Yeah.
I knew it was him going through his life. And in the letter, he goes, I think you need to, you're the person who needs to have this. Hmm. And I'm like, wow, if I hadn't have been open, if I hadn't been going, you know, how can I witness to someone if I'm not even in the realm of their conversation?
Yeah.
And then at the end of that, having basically that important of an impact on someone that he would nail something to me.
Yeah.
And he passed away about a year and a half ago. So,
this man who was an enemy, mm-hmm. you made a friend out of him.
Made a friend. And you can make friends out of just about anyone out there. And I think it's our duty to be, you know, through kindness and understanding. It's that understanding piece. Because maybe we're a white belt, maybe we're a green belt. But the next step is just being open to the next step and being used.
Isn't that good? Yeah. That's good, Brian. Thank you for that. Appreciate it. His family's actually traveling to Great Britain at the end of August. And he says he wants to go and take, I should have asked this, but take pictures, you know, for Scott, in memory of Scott. That's a beautiful thing. I want to close with this. The book of John includes a wonderful little story arc that's easy to miss, and it's the story of Nicodemus. Nicodemus was a Pharisee, and while basically all of his colleagues were violently opposed to the ministry of Jesus, Nicodemus saw something in him and was drawn to him. So in chapter 3, he visited Jesus at night so nobody would see, under cover of darkness. And rather than turning him out, Jesus received him with kindness. And they proceeded to have one of the most important and profound conversations recorded in the New Testament. That's where we get John 3:16, the most known verse in all the world. And they talked about new life. They talked about being born again. We know those verses. But at the end of the conversation, Jesus tells him this. He says, for everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God. It's a subtle line, isn't it? It's drenched in grace, but it's also pointed. Whoever does what is true comes to the light. Well, see, Nicodemus had come in darkness. He wasn't willing to be seen in the light. And it's good that he had come at all, truly. But Jesus is giving him a challenge here. You must come to Jesus in the light. And he hardly shows up again through the rest of the Gospels. He pops in chapter 19 again, after Jesus has been killed. And Joseph of Arimathea has agreed to take Jesus' body. And in verse 39, we get this. And there came also Nicodemus, who had first come to him by night. bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloe, about 100 pounds. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen cloths with spices, as the custom of the Jews is to bury. You see that? He had first come at night. He had first come in the darkness, but now he comes before sundown. He comes where everyone can see, and he brings his generous gift in honor of the rabbi who changed his heart. It's the kindness of Jesus that brought Nicodemus to repentance and transformed him into a man who was kind and was generous. Friends, please, let's not underestimate the importance and the power of this fruit. Kindness will alter lives forever. And we have the honor of giving it to others as it was given first to us. Amen? Let's stand together.